Hugh Wolf, Director of Orchestras for the New England Conservatory. Thank you so much for joining us.
Delighted to be here. Thank you.
And thank you so much for offering these recordings for the Symphony at 8 for WCRB. It's such a thrill to be able to present the NEC orchestras. What's your general feeling? You have been a conductor and music director for professional orchestras throughout your career, but you focus a great deal of your time on education and specifically NEC. What's the reason for that?
Well, I guess after a lifetime of conducting professionals, it was a really fun and interesting change to work with students, to work with younger pre-professionals, I guess we can call them at NEC. First of all, the level is incredibly high. These kids are really, really well trained and well prepared, partly because of the school and also just even before they get to the school. A lot of them are coming in at a very high level. And I find also that the whole notion of where are we in classical music and where are we going and what is the future? I mean, obviously the future is the young, and if this generation is going to be the future of classical music, you know, I feel I should do my part to, you know, give them whatever guidance and encouragement and inspiration I can. And I find that really fun. I would say without exception, they are amazingly passionate about music in our society. I think sometimes it feels like they're swimming against the current. Classical music is not central in our society, but in a lovely way, these students are really excited and passionate. And I think see it as a personal mission to inspire audiences of the future, to find those audiences and to get them hooked on classical music the way they were perhaps as younger kids, and to proselytize and be advocates for an art form they really believe in, that we all really believe in.
It's marvelous that young listeners, young classical musicians, as you're talking about, can kind of take the technology and the culture the way as it is in the 21st century and use it to proselytize this way.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. I think I have a son who's a young musician at a different conservatory, and I find that, yeah, the way they put on concerts, the way they publicize the concerts, the way they reach potential audience members, a lot of that has to do with social media. A lot of that has to do with just the way they communicate with their peers. It's different from how I communicated with my peers, but I'm delighted that they're using the most kind of up-to-date technology to spread the word about an art form that's actually very old.
And the music that we have for this week on the Symphonies at 8 is a wide variety, and I think probably a great kind of eclectic example of the kinds of things that you tackle at NEC, beginning on Monday with the Haffner Symphony by Mozart. Give me a little sense of why that's a good piece for young people.
Well, there's obviously the core repertoire. I mean, a lot of them have played a lot of repertoire over the years, youth orchestras, other experiences, summer festivals. But I think we want to get a very important mix of making sure they're exposed to the core repertoire, that they're stretched in some ways with contemporary music or new music, or even they're stretched with older music, pre-classical Baroque music, or just out-of-the-way music that they haven't run across. So we're always looking for a pretty wide variety of repertoire, maybe even wider and a little more daring than a professional orchestra can get away with, because they're trying to sell a lot of tickets and our concerts are free. So yes, I think above all, it's the education of the kid and giving the students experience with and access to as broad a repertoire as possible.
And Mozart is no picnic for...
Yeah, I mean, Haffner Symphony, of course, is a extremely well-known symphony, but maybe the audience members are not aware that, for example, on cello, viola, and bass, it tends to be an audition piece because it has, then the last one has very fast passage work for viola, cello, and bass that I think even in Mozart's time was... was extremely unusual and very difficult. And to this day, you'll find it on orchestral auditions for professional orchestras.
And then on Tuesday, the Shostakovich Fifth Symphony is such a historically significant piece. Is there some sense that you want to kind of bring history and the whole idea of the history of Shostakovich into the program?
You're absolutely right. And I think it is not necessarily something that the younger kids are all that aware of. In fact, nowadays, frankly, if you talk to a younger orchestra and you say, so how many of you know who Stalin was? A large number don't. And, that maybe isn't part of the curriculum. And I think it's very important that they get more of a picture of mid-20th century history. For my generation, that was recent history. For this generation, that's, dare I say it, kind of ancient history. So it's important to put things in context. I think it's very important for conservatories where so much time is spent strictly on the achievement of technical perfection to put the music in the historical context. And with Shostakovich, interestingly, I find that once you go there, the students react in a very intense way. And in fact, I would rate Shostakovich up there with Mahler, Beethoven, Stravinsky, Bartok, as the composers that the young generation seem to respond to most viscerally. And I wouldn't have said that was true of my generation. In my generation, Shostakovich was a more complex character. And those that were into really avant-garde, cutting-edge music thought of him as kind of retro and maybe not so interesting, myself included at the time as a young composer. Nowadays, there's something about the emotional power and depth of that music that very much speaks to younger people, as does Mahler.
I was wondering if you could step back and just give a two-minute description of the context in which Shostakovich was trying to create this thing.
Yes.
Would you say to an orchestra?
Yeah, I think the most important thing someone who does not know the context of Shostakovich Fifth should know is that in 1937, I believe it was January of 1937, he was at that point, I guess, 31 years old, very successful, very gifted, very popular, and had written an opera called Lady Macbeth of Mtsensk, which had received quite a few well-received performances in Moscow and Leningrad, I believe. And on that day, a really, really bad review came out in Pravda, the official Communist Party newspaper at the time. And it's assumed that the review was either written by Stalin, who had seen the performance, or obviously, if not written by him, he expressed disgust and distaste, and his minions then translated that into a review. And a review like that for a young composer at that time, in the mid-30s in the Soviet Union, was potentially life-threatening. It was certainly career-threatening and could even be life-threatening. Artists who fell out of favor had fates ranging from disappearing, being executed, to prison time, to ends of careers, never being able to find work again. So Shostakovich suddenly found himself as someone who was very much unsure where his future lay. And I think for the next 30 years, I mean, he lived another 40, so for the next, most of the next 25, certainly for the next 18 until Stalin died, he never knew quite where he stood, and he became very good at playing the game of writing music that wouldn't get him in trouble with the authorities, but somehow was able to communicate deeper feelings to those that might want to listen with open ears and open hearts. And I think he stands out as a 20th century composer who was extremely good at that. And that was a task that most composers were not faced with, how to write in code, essentially, how to write music that could be understood on different levels depending on who was listening and wouldn't get you in trouble, but could also be somehow speaking the truth.
Amazing kind of dual interpretation that could be made for that symphony.
Yes, a great number of Soviet artists will say that the symphony was a huge success. He even subtitled it An Artist's Response to Just Criticism. So he knew, you know, just what he had to do to feel safe again. But yeah, most Soviet citizens, I think, that heard it at that time were overwhelmed by the emotional power of the music, regardless of whether they saw it as a political statement or not. That just the depth and the plumbing of human emotion is very, very profound.
And then Wednesday, we have the Berlioz Symphonie Fantastique. Talk about emotional undercurrents there. It's a completely different set of
emotions. I would rank it as one of the most original and important pieces ever written. Certainly for orchestral players, it's critical that you know this piece and a little bit about it. It was written just 3 years after Beethoven died. So if you put it in that context, rather than think of it as, you know, 20 years before Wagner, 3 years after Beethoven, it really is extraordinary. And he was able to break all the rules and do a million new things that no symphonic composer had ever really done before, and created this vast canvas, of course, following this kind of crazy story of an artist who's spurned by a unrequited love and take some opium. I mean, it's really, it breaks all the rules and goes past all the boundaries, but it's lasted for good reason, and it's a heck of a lot of fun to play. And again, I think kids really, really grab onto this one with both hands and don't let go.
Yeah, it strikes me that Berlioz had... It was just crazy enough that people would let him do this kind of thing.
Yeah, you know? I mean, he was a really larger-than-life character. And this is fairly early in his career, but you can see the confidence and the swagger of the character that someone 27 years old could go this far and have the confidence that it would work.
And then Thursday, the Pastoral Symphony of Beethoven. I think Beethoven and the understanding of Beethoven's music has to be central to a program of orchestral music.
Yes, I would say that every year we do at least one. And over the course of any one student's 4 years or two or 4 years there, we hope that they get multiple exposures to works like these, you know, the Beethoven symphonies above all, but the Brahms, the Mozart, the Mahler, the Tchaikovsky, these are, but yes, I think every year we make sure we do a Beethoven or two, and we make sure we don't repeat one, so that someone over a four-year span may have the opportunity to play almost all of them and not play one more than once, because there's only 4 years to cover 9 symphonies.
And the sixth has this wonderful kind of painting of a picture that the others don't really have.
Yeah, Beethoven was a guy who took a long, long walk every day, rain or shine, and kind of muttered to himself, evidently, people that saw him walk by and had little bits of scraps of notepaper he might be writing on. And I think his works gestated in these walks. Nature was very important to him. And this is his, as you suggest, overtly nature story piece complete with subtitles, elaborate subtitles about, you know, going out into the countryside and the scene by the brook and the peasants merrymaking, and then a big storm, and then after the storm, everybody relaxes that they're safe after the storm. So it tells a story, it tells a beautiful story, and at the same time, it's a rigorously organized classical symphony, and I think has some of the most subtle and beautiful music of Beethoven's. Not the breast-beating heroic style, but for conductors, actually, it's one of my favorites. I think it's very subtle. It requires perhaps even more rehearsal than the seventh, which is seemingly more difficult. So I think it's an important challenge, and one that sometimes gets slightly neglected. And the even-numbered symphonies, 2, 4, 6, and 8, we need to make sure they're part of our curriculum as well.
Yeah, they're sometimes thought of as too nice.
Yes, indeed.
But in the case of the sixth, it seems like he's exploring feelings.
Oh, yeah.
Emotion.
Yeah. I think it is very, very deeply felt, and it's important for the musicians to understand that.
On Friday, it's the Mahler Fifth Symphony, and what an amazing exploration of feeling that is.
Yes, and Mahler has become really central. really central to the repertoire all over the world, and particularly to younger people. Whenever we announce that we're going to do a Mahler symphony, you have the sense in the air that all the players are competing to play in that orchestra, you know, because they're divided among various orchestras at the school, and whether we like it or not, that seems to be the destination orchestra if there's a Mahler symphony on the program, and kids really want to play. The fifth, of course, is a purely orchestral symphony without voices. So it's, again, central to the orchestra department's work.
Because so many of the Mahler symphonies include the
human voice. Yes, they become, in a way, more complex for us to mount. We've never mounted the eighth at the school. I think it would pretty much be impossible. We haven't done Das Lied von der Erde, but we've done virtually all the others in one form or another. But the purely instrumental ones, this year we'll be doing the first. Those, I think, are key to part of our orchestral training. And this performance, I think we started the season with it. We often start the season with something quite challenging. And I think that gets us off to a kind of a running start. There's no time to to look back. When we do the very first concert of the school year, the parts are assigned 2 days before the first rehearsal. That's how quickly we have to get organized. Normally, the parts are assigned 2 weeks before the first rehearsal. But in the case of this Mahler 5, it was 2 days before. So the first rehearsal, people have barely had time to pick up the music and look at it, and we just try to hit the ground running. I think that creates a good atmosphere, and it creates a kind of a real sense of purpose that focuses the mind. Nobody has time to get bored in the first month of school.
Kind of a baseline for your activity, and it also uses such a wide spectrum of instrumentation.
It's a big orchestra, and in fact, we held special auditions for the solo French horn part in the third movement. There's a part in the score where the first horn is actually separate from the rest of the horns and has a separate line. And in the rest of the symphony, that first horn, of course, plays first horn, but plays as part of a section. But in the third movement, it's almost like a little tiny horn concerto. I shouldn't say little tiny. It's a big part. But it's integrated into the orchestra, but a part like that will have a separate audition for all the French horn players in the school.
And that adagietto is just so exquisite. Mm-hmm. Just a beautiful, beautiful thing. So, as you say, you're doing Mahler coming up September 28th. That's right.
Mahler's first. And this year, this coming school year, we have decided to have the work of a living composer on virtually every program we do, with a very special, strong emphasis on women composers. So the very first concert, Anna Klein, a young British composer, we're doing her 20-minute symphonic poem, Night Fairy, commissioned by the Chicago Symphony, premiered by Riccardo Muti in the Chicago Symphony a few years ago, in a pairing with the first Mahler Symphony. So that gives you a kind of glimpse at what we're up to this year.
That's very exciting. And is it fun to kind of audition the various pieces by new composers?
Yes, it is. And I think traditionally on the first concert every year, we've done a pretty big new piece, not just a little opener, but a big Tandun concerto for orchestra a few years ago, and Esa-Pekka Salonen's L.A. Variations, John Adams' Dr. Atomic Symphony. So we've done big pieces, not just token concert openers. I mean, of course, often the contemporary piece is a shorter piece because there's so much core repertoire we need to cover as well. But at the beginning of the year, to have a real statement about new music on the orchestral program, I think, is important.
That's fantastic. Thank you so much. And congratulations on your appointment in Belgium, the National Symphony of Belgium, as of next September.
Yeah, I'll be traveling there more often next year. This year, I'm still pretty much here full time, and I'll stay here in my capacity as director of orchestras at NEC.
And do you feel like there's a special advantage to having European and American connections both at the same time?
I guess that's just been part of what I've done over the years. I was 9 years the chief conductor in Frankfurt, Germany, and lived in England for 5 years with my kids, my wife and my kids. So, yeah, I think Europe is where a lot of this music is from. So it's just interesting to be working in Europe and to see how they're coping with some of the same problems we're coping with in terms of young people, young audiences, the future of the art form, and so forth.
All kinds of new ideas coming from orchestras in Europe, I know. Well, thank you so much, Hugh Wolf.
Pleasure.
And it's looking forward to that concert. Mahler, the First Symphony, plus the other composer.
Anna Klein,
Night Ferry. Night Ferry, and that's 7:30 p.m. on September 28th at NEC's Jordan Hall.